and are perhaps a little different than I guess I have held in the past. Perhaps the best place to start is to determine what is government, what is meant by this. And I'll give you a definition of government from an American law book titled Corpus Juris Secunda. It says, government, a very comprehensive term derived from the Latin gubernaculum, signifying the instrument, the helm, whereby the ship, to which the state is often compared, is guided on its course by the gubernator or helmsman. In its ordinary signification, the act or fact of governing. Control, direction, the exercise of authority, regulating the action of something, guidance, management, regulation. So it is a pretty comprehensive term. Government basically is a state or condition whereby a certain thing is controlled, regulated, restrained, or managed. The term has often been ascribed to a group or body of people, but perhaps more correctly signifies the authority to act or the act of controlling. Government is also force, as George Washington stated. And like any other force, such as a car or a gun or electricity, it has a potential danger attached to it. So it comes down to whether how is it being controlled and who's controlling it. The principle of government perhaps started with the family, where you had the head of the family or a patriarch who was guiding and directing and managing the affairs of the family or the clan. So we might ask, what authority is there for government to exist in a land such as ours? And the Bible tells us that God is omnipotent, he is king of the earth, he possesses all authority. But if God has all authority, then he can certainly give or delegate some of that authority in some respects to man, and has indeed done so. He gave the right of dominion to Adam, to Abraham, and Jacob. He gave Pilate authority to govern. He gave Nebuchadnezzar power to rule. Or as Romans 13:1 says, the powers that be are established by God. And in Proverbs 8:15-16, God says, by me kings reign and princes decree justice. In what manner then does this apply to us? Well, God also gave Israel, as a people, authority or a right to govern certain things. The laws and judgments were given to Israel as a nation or as a group. Thus, they were given with the intent that they be kept and preserved through a group effort. This national or group effort is government. It was an authority given to the people as a whole. God didn't give this to any specific individual, such as the elders or Moses. Take a look at Exodus 24. This is at a period of time when all of the commandments were given, the Ten Commandments, and the corresponding statutes and judgments. In Exodus 24:3, it says, and Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all of the words which the Lord has said, we will do. So God says, will you do these things? And people said, yes. So when God told Israel as a nation to keep the law, to exact justice, to punish those that violate the law, he conferred upon the people the authority to act in doing these things. It was their right to govern themselves or to exercise powers of government, what might be called today political rights or sovereignty. I'd like to relate that to what has happened in America. And I'd like to quote something from an early American court case. It's a court case called Chisholm versus Georgia. This is a very old case, goes back to 1793. It's very lengthy and explains a lot of interesting things about law and government. Here John Jay is speaking, and he says that at the Revolution, the sovereignty of the king or the crown of Great Britain passed to the people, and along with it, the title to lands. But he says that this sovereignty entitled to lands did not pass to the colonies or to the states or even to the people of the colonies, but to the whole people. What is this sovereignty that he's talking about? He says, sovereignty is the right to govern. In Europe, the sovereignty is generally ascribed to the prince. Here, it rests with the people. So when Israel had said, give us a king, what they did is they surrendered God's commission to govern to that king. At that time, what has happened is that the sovereignty, their right to govern, passed to the king. At our revolution, that sovereignty passed from the king back to the people, right where God had originally placed it, at Mount Sinai. It was, in a sense, a restitution of things regarding this matter of government. From that time when they said, give us a king, up until the revolution, for nearly 3,000 years, we have been under some sort of king, prince, monarch, or aristocrat. So this is a very significant event, something to think about some more. Next, I'd like to talk about what's the purpose or function of government. When Israel first became a nation after coming out of Egypt, they immediately discovered one of the necessary purposes and functions of government, and that was to settle disputes and judgment. Turn to Exodus 18. In Exodus 18:16, Moses is talking to his father-in-law, and he says, when they, the people, have a matter or dispute, they come to me, and I judge between one and the other, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws. So there needs to be an authority to settle disputes between persons. Just as there are disputes in the family, somebody with authority must decide the matter according to the law. This authority to judge controversies was reaffirmed in Deuteronomy 25, 25:1 says, if there be a controversy between men and they come unto judgment, that the judges may judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. So there's always has been disputes between men, and there always will be, and that's one of the necessary purposes of government. Second function is to enforce law. God told Israel to keep the law, which they agreed to do. The word keep infers an authority to enforce, to make it effective in the land. Law will never exist in a land without some authority or force behind it. Some would say that we could have either government or God's law, as though the two are contrary to one another. The laws would fall by the wayside in a nation without some manner of force behind them. We had this force in early America, and the laws were kept. The nature of these laws, particularly the national laws, requires government. With the physical laws God created, he supplied some force in nature that keeps these laws from being violated and keeps order in the physical realm. These laws thus are self-executing. But with non-physical laws, such as we find in the Bible, there needs to be some sort of external force acting upon them that they may be executed, made operative, and to keep order in the land. And that force is government. Second function would be to punish lawbreakers. As Romans 13:4 says, the civil ruler is an avenger who brings wrath upon one who practices evil. Thus, government is to assure penalties fit to crime, whether it be death by stoning or hanging or whatever, or the manner and form of restitution. Fourth function is to protect the rights and property of people. And this is the end result of doing the other three functions, the judgment, the enforcement, and the punishment. next area I'd like to share some thoughts on is that regarding citizenship. Citizen is derived from the Latin word civis, and it basically means a free inhabitant of a city. Quote something here from Webster's 1828 dictionary on citizen. It says, a native of a city or an inhabitant who enjoys the freedom and privileges of the city in which he resides, the freeman of a city, a townsman, an inhabitant in a general sense, a native or permanent resident in a city or country as a citizen of London or Philadelphia, the citizens of the United States. So it's basically a citizen is a member of a city or a country. Governments do not have citizens. Countries or cities do. One is a citizen of a city or a state, which includes a land, a people, a religion, a set of laws, and a government. This is commonly called a jural society. Lately, some have found an aversion to the title of citizen. They have said citizens hadn't existed since the 14th Amendment, or that only those in government or Washington, D.C. are citizens. Some have spent hundreds of man hours trying to find some way to conclude that they are not citizens, specifically citizens of the United States. They have distorted history, signed declarations, filed affidavits, written books, devised forms, held meetings, searched out court cases, misapplied meanings to certain words, put government officials on notice, and rearranged the law to suit their understanding of things. They proclaim instead to be non-resident aliens. Now, there's actually a good reason for this, but because they don't understand the whole picture of what's going on, they're saying and doing a lot of wrong and incorrect things. I'd like to probably clarify this up by a biblical example. It goes to Joshua 9. In Joshua chapter 9, what we find here is going on is a conquest of Canaan. The Israelites had come into Canaan. They had already taken over Jericho and Ai, and they're about to come upon another city of Gibeon. And this is what had happened. Joshua 9:3. I'm going to be reading this from the Fenton translation. The inhabitants of Gibeon also heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, but they acted with cunning and went and took worn saddles on their asses and old wineskins broken and patched, and old patched shoes on their feet, and worn clothes upon them, and all their bread and provisions were made moldy. They came thus to Joshua in the camp of Gilgal, and said to him and the princes of Israel, we have come from a distant country and wish you to make a treaty with us. But the leader of Israel replied, do you reside among the Hivites? If so, I cannot make a treaty with you. What was he asking him? Are you a resident of this land? Are you a citizen of Canaan? That's what the Israelites wanted to know. And the Gibeonites went out of their way. They did all this work, made all their provisions moldy. They put on the worn shoes, the tattered clothing. Why? To make it look like they came from a far country and to say they weren't residents. What were they saying? That they were non-resident aliens. That's what they wanted the new government to believe. See, Israel was becoming the new government in the land. They were taking over the land. In verse 8 it says, they, however, answered Joshua and says, we are your servants. Now Joshua inquired, who are you? In other words, what's your status? And whence do you come from? They answered, your servants come from a very distant country. What were they saying again? We're not citizens here. See, what they saw what was happening to their fellow citizens in Jericho and Ai. And they didn't want that to happen to us. It's just like patriots today. They see what's happening to their fellow citizens. They're being thrown in jail. They're being harassed by the IRS. They're being licensed and regulated. And all these oppressive laws put upon them. Because And thus they don't want to be called citizens like them. In a country that's undergoing conquest by a hostile force, the last thing you ever want to be is a citizen of that country. But now the shoe's on the other foot. It's the Canaanites that are invading our land. And they're against the original citizenry, the white citizenry. And they're going to tax them, and they're going to regulate them, and they're going to license them, and they're going to find ways to kill them. And people are hiding in corners and devising legal means to shield themselves from it, and they're afraid to call themselves citizens. This is the same thing that happened back when Christ was captured and Peter denied Christ. They asked Peter, "Are you a disciple of Christ?" "No." "Are you one of those Galileans?" "Nope." "Your speech betrays you, I can tell you are." "No, I'm not one of them." You see what had happened in the land? A power change had undergone. Christ was in captivity. The scribes and Pharisees had advanced in power, and nobody wanted to go around saying that they were a disciple, that they were a Galilean. Peter was just like a lot of modern-day patriots, that they're afraid of the situation, and they don't understand the whole situation that's going on. So the new government that has taken over Canaan was the Israelites. And they had a law against the Canaanites, which was death. And our invaders, our conquerors of this land, also have a law against us, the Israelites, the original citizenry. That's just the nature of when one people conquers another nation. And I have seen patriots just go out and distort history, such as something like the Dred Scott case, which clearly defines citizens as being confined to the white race. Well, many want to try to hide themselves in some legally constructed closet so nobody can see them, but what we need to do is get the Canaanites out of the land, not to hide our title of citizen. The next topic I'd like to discuss is that regarding jails and prisons. What is the government role regarding jails and prisons? How do they fit in? Many have said that there is no mention of jails and prisons in the Bible. They're ungodly and should not be used. Well, this always kind of bothered me somewhat, so I looked and I'll share what I found. Turn to Leviticus 24. Leviticus 24:11, and this comes from the King James, it says, "And the Israelitish woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed, and they brought him to Moses." Verse 12, "And they put him inward that the mind of the Lord might be shown to them." They put him inward. Your translation probably says they put him in captivity. The Fairfenton says that they put this man under guard. What did they do with him? They put him in prison or a jail, temporarily at least. Turn to Numbers 15 once. Numbers 15:32. "And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath. And they that found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to the congregation. And they put him inward," in captivity, custody, "because it was not declared what should be done with him." Okay, so again, here we have a case where this guy was violating the Sabbath. He was arrested, and he was put in a jail, confined somehow. You know, whatever word you want to use. And that these words, in custody or inward, refer to prisons that you can find in Genesis 40 is one example. Genesis 43, it says, "And he put them inward," or in custody, "in the house of the captain of the guard, into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound." Now, after they confined this guy, did God say, "Don't put people in prison anymore"? And there's no mention of it. Another example is in Ezra 7. In Ezra 7:26, it says, "And whoever will not do the law of thy God or the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be unto death, or to banishment, or to confiscation of goods, or to imprisonment." So apparently at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, they were employing the concept of imprisoning. There are about 100 references in the Bible to prisons, about 50 in the Old Testament, 50 in the New. Yet it is continually stated that prisons are not in the Bible. They are not scriptural and so forth. Even God has used the concept of prisons. He imprisoned Jonah in the great whale. Why did God imprison Jonah in the whale? As punishment. He wouldn't do what he told them. Patriots offer much condemnation against prisons, but there is no real condemnation of prisons per se in the Bible. Why the distortion and misunderstanding? It's because we see today the horrible misuse of prisons being used as an instrument of control and oppression. Thus, the immediate emotional response is to be against it. There are some proper uses of the concept of imprisonment, but the emotional heart finds it easier to reject the entire concept than to figure out when appropriate and how to put it in its proper perspective. Another area I'd like to share some thoughts was that regarding victimless crimes. Here, many have asserted that government has no authority to enact and enforce victimless crimes. That people can do what they want so long as they do not infringe upon anybody's right to life, liberty, and property. I had wondered, where's the basis for this? And there was a kind of a basic premise to this in American law, but I had been suspicious that it was being distorted out of context, so I turned to the Bible to see what it says. Let's go back, for instance, to the case where the man was gathering sticks. He was arrested, put in jail. He now becomes before Judge Moses, and his argument goes like this, that he did not harm anybody's property or damage anybody's property, that he did not infringe upon anybody's right to life, liberty, or property. You cannot prosecute until you bring forth the damaged party, and thus you have no jurisdiction to try this case. So Moses scratches his head and says, "Well, you got me there, case dismissed." Could that have happened? No. It wasn't a valid argument then, and it wouldn't be a valid argument today. I'll quickly share something with you from one particular newsletter that touches upon this subject. This newsletter's topic is victimless crimes and how government should never enforce victimless crimes and how wrong they are. Well, let's see what they say. I'll quote here. Say, "A victimless crime is a misnomer, a non-crime. It is unreal. There can be no crime without a damaged victim. If no victim can be produced, there was no crime committed. However, the state convicts people of crimes against the state, even when there is no victim or identifiable damage." Was there any identifiable damage in the guy who violated the Sabbath law? Anybody's right to life, liberty, or property damage? No. The sentence that came down to this man was death. And that judicial decree did not come from Moses, it came directly from God. just as it was in the blasphemy case. What about blasphemy? What's wrong with that? That guy didn't harm anybody. He wasn't violating anybody's right to life, liberty, or property. It doesn't matter. How about something like sodomy? What's wrong with that? Two consenting adults are not bothering anybody, but yet there's a sentence against that also. It is a victimless crime. But interracial marriage. How does the act of marriage infringe upon anybody's right to life, liberty, or property? It doesn't. Adultery could also be a victimless crime. Prostitution, pornography. You know, they always used to close down the burlesque shows and the whorehouses. They're all consenting adults. They're all in agreement to what's going on. Nobody's property is being damaged. Nobody's rights are being infringed. How about idolatry, witchcraft, enchanting, sorcery? No victim, no identifiable damage. And how about this thing of usury? What in the world is wrong with that? This guy over here needs $1,000, and this guy over here says, I'll give you $1,000 if you give me back 5% interest after two months. He's happy because he's going to get what he needs, the money. And this guy over here is happy because he's going to get an extra $50. But then the wicked, tyrannical government enacts a victimless crime, prohibiting usury. And it disrupts their happiness and their way of life and what they're doing. You see, God did not say it's okay if nobody complains or nobody's rights are violated. He said it's against the law, and that's it. The argument of a victimless crime is not a definitive criteria. It's something that probably could be raised in a purely civil suit, but we're concerned here with the powers of government. What did God give us authority to do? Thus, to most patriots, God, I suppose, would be a tyrant, because he enacts and requires the enforcement of victimless crimes. This concept, I guess, has been distorted by the fact that there are a lot of crimes being enacted by government, such as crimes of prevention and licensing and so forth, that they have no authority to do. But yet you can take any good, true, sound, godly principle and distort it to a point where it's misapplied and it can be harmful and dangerous. The thing to do is not to reject the entire concept. If you're unable to, most are unable to separate in their minds the distortion and the abuse of the precept from the truth of the thing, and thus to deny or dismiss the entire concept. So most are just unable to put this thing into proper perspective. Now, connected to this thing of crime, what about law? What type of law can we have? We always hear man's law versus God's law. What is the source of the type of law we can have? What is the criteria of law? Are only the valid laws found in the Bible, those that are called biblical? Well, to clarify biblical, many have made this mistake and myself, biblical does not mean godly. Biblical is an adjective of the noun Bible, and thus biblical means in or of the Bible. Something is either biblical or it's non-biblical. It's either in the Bible or it's not in the Bible. There is no such word as unbiblical, by the way. That's an improper use of the prefix un with the word biblical. There are both godly and ungodly things in the Bible. Idolatry is biblical. The Bible is full of cases of idolatry. But idolatry is also non-biblical. There's many cases we're going right out in our midst that are not in the Bible, recorded in the Bible. Man's laws are biblical. There are many instances where man is doing his own thing, his own way. Man's laws are also non-biblical, such as we see going on in Washington, D.C. I'd like to share something with you from a regarding this topic. This has come from a very knowledgeable scientist by the name of Dr. Knott. He says, man can invent nothing in science or religion but falsehood, and all the truths which he discovers are but facts or laws which have emanated from the Creator. All science, therefore, may be regarded as a revelation from him. Can man invent science? He can't. He can devise a piano or a car, but those conform to laws that have already existed. All man has discovered that if you put this thing here and apply this force there, that it does this. So as Dr. Knott says, man can't invent anything in science. He can't create anything. Can man create law? No. All law, all science emanates from the Creator, as he says. The Bible talks about God as the God of truth. Is all truth in the Bible? It would be an absurdity to say so. It would be really limiting our God in his authority and power. There are so many truths that are not in the Bible. Thus, there are truths that are both biblical and non-biblical. Are all laws of God in the Bible? No, they're not. There are many axioms of math, there's maxims of law that are true, are valid. They always hold true. They're unquestionably of God, of God's order, but they're not recorded in the Bible. So the ultimate question of a thing is not so much whether it's biblical or not biblical, but whether it's godly or ungodly. And that's what I think we have to ask in a lot of things. Many have deemed things ungodly solely because they're not in the Bible, and that's an error in thinking. The next subject I'd like to share some thoughts with is that regarding centralized government. We hear an awful lot of talk about concept of centralized government. Many believe that all of our troubles today are the product of centralized government, stating that such a thing is not authorized by the Bible. Centralized government, as one patriot, and I'll state it, says, comes from the pits of hell and is used by tyrants and usurpers to control people only and to destroy freedom. It says that it's a device of man. It is not of God and totally non-biblical. Well, let's take a close look and see how non-biblical it is. The patriarchal governments, Noah, Abraham, Jacob, they controlled all the affairs of the clan or tribe, directed the affairs and so forth. It was a centralized government. When Israel first became a nation, coming out of Egypt, there was Moses. Moses was a type of civil military leader. He was a type of central authority. Not an all-exclusive authority, but yet it was a type of, all the people were amenable to him in certain respects as far as judgment and so forth. And after him, Joshua, it's basically the same thing. After Joshua, there were the judges that God raised up. They were in some sense the chief executive officers. They controlled the military affairs of the nation, and they also were the judge. So in a limited sense, they were a centralized authority also. When this judge died, God raised up another one. After Eli, the high priest, died, Samuel became the chief religious leader. He was the only judge, and he was a prophet. This is a lot of concentration of authority and power in one man's hand. But yet, who can say it's not of God? In 2 Chronicles 19:5 through 11, find Jehoshaphat had judges in all the cities and established a type of supreme court at Jerusalem. And in the days of Nehemiah was a chief civil leader and became governor of Judah. In a certain respect, he was a central authority. It was through this central authority that the walls were rebuilt, the city fortified, the enemies warded off, and the law established in the land. And what is this that the Bible speaks about Jesus Christ being the head of the church, guiding and directing all of the members thereof? It's centralized government. Is it of the pits of hell or of God? And they say, though, that things were pretty good in America before the evil, diabolical, conspiratorial plan of central government under the Constitution was put in operation. Well, let's look at some historical facts. Central government existed before the Constitution. Central government existed before any of the states existed. When the delegates from the various colonies met on September 5th, 1774, to discuss the matters and problems they were facing in Philadelphia, they possessed the fundamental powers of government. Peyton Randolph of Virginia was chosen president of the Congress, and Patrick Henry stood up and said, "The distinctions between Virginians, Pennsylvanians, and New Englanders is no more. I am not a Virginian, but an American." So he apparently recognized that there's some change, there's a centralized authority existing there. This Continental Congress that was formed was a central government representing all the people and the colonies. It was our first true government in America. The states came later. The states were never true sovereign national entities like Germany or England. They never possessed the powers to declare war or conclude peace, to send and receive ambassadors, to regulate foreign commerce, to make treaties. They never possessed admiralty jurisdiction and other powers. These are international powers, powers under the law of nations. These powers were always lodged in that Continental Congress or the centralized government. The warnings that were sent to the king were done and through the central government. The Declaration of Independence was done not by the states, not by the people. What does it say? In Congress, July 4th, 1776, in the central government. Congress organized the militia and commissioned the officers to fight in that war. And the Treaty of Paris was orchestrated through that central government. In short, our independence was planned, declared, fought, won, and concluded through the mechanism of centralized government. It was not done by New Jersey or Pennsylvania or the people acting free and independently. It never could have been accomplished like that. We have to understand that it is nearly impossible to have government without some centralization of authority existing somewhere, no matter how much we divide it up or whatever. It existed all through the Bible and is founded in American history as well. We need to keep this in mind, though. God's emphasis and concern was not so much on a particular frame of government, but on keeping his law and commandments. And if we can do that by having everybody stand on their head in the corner, well, then fine, do that. So this is just another issue that most are incapable of putting in their proper perspective because of its current abuse that we see today. How much time? How about why does a government become oppressive and destructive? Why do governments fail their intended purposes of providing justice, protecting rights, and upholding law? Soon after God had given the law to the Israelites and established his covenant with them and told them how to govern certain things, the system soon started to fall apart. Lawlessness and idolatry set in. What was the problem? Was it the system? Did God say his laws were a failure? Did he say that government is a bad and corrupt thing? Did he tell Moses, well, we got to start all over and find some new and different way to do things? Well, in Exodus 32:7, he says, "The people have corrupted themselves." This was the problem with the government then. It's the problem with the government now. It does not matter how good of a government you have It will fail if the people become debased and corrupted and unable to govern the affairs properly as God intended. If God himself had come down here in 1700s and says, this is the frame of government to follow, we'd still be in the mess we're in today. There are different modes that people become corrupt and demoralized through their own heart. By the tempting and influences of the serpents and the tares they allow in the land, or through their civil and religious leaders. But it always comes down to it's the people that end up being corrupted, demoralized. The people back then, the statesmen and the men formed government, they knew this concept, this principle. As Edmund Burke in 1777 says, among a people generally corrupt, liberty cannot long exist. George Washington, in a letter to Lafayette in 1788, says, though when a people shall become incapable of governing themselves and fit for a master, it is of little consequence from what quarter he comes. John Hancock, in the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention, 1788, stated, the powers reserved by the people under the Constitution render them secure, and until they themselves become corrupt, they will always have upright and able rulers. This must be Bush and Clinton, I suppose, huh? We have a Bush and Clinton, not because of the government or frame of government, because of the corruption and immorality and irresponsibility of the people. Benjamin Franklin in the Framing Convention, 1787, said, I believe further that this new government under the Constitution is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. In essence, we basically get what we deserve. We could hardly complain what's going on today. At least we can't blame government. It always comes to us. Samuel Adams says, I stated this in 1776, I fully agree in opinion with the celebrated author that freedom or slavery will prevail in a country according as the dispositions and manners of the people render them fit for one or the other. And there's other quotes here by Jefferson and other people as well, basically saying the same thing. But you see, people must find a scapegoat for the national problems that surround them. In place of their own ignorance, corruption, immorality, and irresponsibility. They will blame anything from the devil to the government, to centralized government. They'll blame constitutions and corporations and congresses. They'll blame preachers and lawyers and politicians. That it basically all comes down to, as God says, the people corrupting themselves. See, the problem we have in our land is, in Christian and patriotic circles, we have people making conclusions and opinions about government derived from emotional reactions to superficial observations. They just don't dig down deep enough to see everything. Now, some of these concepts presented may not be too popular. I guess they have not been popular in the past for many. It is always more popular when we got problems in the land to talk about the evil government, its unlawful measures, than to put these things into proper perspective. But this requires a lot of understanding and work and thinking. Anything that requires work and knowledge and responsibility is never too popular to the people. It is always much more popular to present things that appeal to the reactionary whims of the human heart. This message was primarily intended to point out errors in our thinking process regarding current problems surrounding government. You see, it's not the enemy out there with all his power and control over government that really worries and concerns me. It's the lack of wisdom and understanding that our people possess regarding law and government. That is the more fearful thing, in my opinion. Confusion and error reign in the patriot movement because most in it lack wisdom to see the truth and to understand the law, the Bible, the ways of God, and so forth. Too much of what they assert as being valid comes from the heart, from superficial observations. The result of the people who are unable to figure out problems and unable to govern themselves. So I'd like to end this message then with a quote from Proverbs 4:7. It says, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get understanding." Thank you.